What's up, family? Welcome back to another Melanated Faith episode. We are so excited to have an incredible guest with us today. We're a big fan of all our guests, but we're especially appreciate today's guest and her ability to say hard things publicly with love. With us, we have Ekemini Uwan. Ekemini is a public theologian who received her Master of Divinity degree from Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. She's also the co-host of the Truth Table podcast alongside Michelle Higgins and Dr. Christina Edmondson. And Christianity Today has named her among the top 10 new or lesser known female theologians worth knowing. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Christianity Today, and The Witness, among other places. And in her spare time, she enjoys discipling women, spending quality time with her loved ones, and working out. But let me tell you one of my favorite things about Ekemini. She is also a part-time fashionista with a love for thrift store shopping. Okay, she is dressed so well, head to toe, all the time. I love seeing her style and how she expresses her love for fashion. So let's welcome Ekemini to the show.
Okay, I feel like before we get started and jump into the meat of the interview, when I was reading your bio, the part-time fashionista thrift store shopping really struck me, and we have listeners everywhere, so I just needed to know some of your favorite thrift stores, because you always look so good. Like, so good.
So
good. I was shocked. I was like, oh my gosh, she shops at thrift stores? I need to get on.
Listen, I am a thrifter, okay? I did not grow up with a lot of money. I still ain't got a lot of money. So I believe in thrifting. And so, my goodness, my favorite, well, there. R.I.P. There was a Salvation Army near my hometown in California that every time I went home, this was a ritual. Me, my mom, and my sisters and my cousins would have to go to this. We called it Salvi. Okay, this is very Nigerian. We got to shorten everything. Salvi, we got to go to Salvi. And so we go. And this place just had so much just great merchandise, shoes, purses, dresses, all the things. And this last time I was home, I was just home. I left home at maybe the beginning of September, and my cousin told me that Salvi shut down, and I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know. How am I going to carry on? I'm really hurt about this. So Salvation Army is one of my spots.
Okay.
Honestly, that's my primary spot. And then there is this one vintage store in San Diego that I love. It's called, I don't know if it's still around, but it's called Flashbacks. I'm rarely ever in San Diego. So whenever I'm there, I already know. I've set aside some money knowing that when I go to San Diego, I got to go to Flashbacks. Because they have kind of like, it's like more of a retro vibe. Yeah, so they purposely get really nice, one-of-a-kind, unique throwback. Yes. You know, all the jewelry and dresses and shoes. And so I go in when I go to Flashbacks, but I haven't been to Flashbacks in many moons.
That's good to know. That's
yeah,
good to know.
I love
like
thrifting.
I said, she is so stylish, y'all. So,
thank
Salvi,
y'all.
Thank if you're San Diego, Flashbacks.
I know. I mean, Salvi, that's going to stay with me. I'm not going to lie. I'm going to attribute it to you, but I'm going to tell people I'm going to Salvi.
I'm going to tell my family, look, y'all, we on the map now. We made Salvi a thing.
I love it.
Okay, so I think just to get people an understanding who might not know, help people know what a public theologian actually is, what does that mean, and why is it important for there to be Black women doing theology publicly?
Yes. Okay. So public theologian, how do I define it? What is a public theologian, right? My definition about this varies, but I often describe it in two ways is helpful. I think one is that I'm having a conversation about God in public, and then sometimes I'm having a conversation with God in public. Sometimes those conversations with God in public or about God in public show up on my podcast that I co-host, Truth Table, right? So we're thinking about culture and politics and race and pop culture, all these things, and just trying to see like, okay, what's the Christian lens? What's the theological import, you know, of about these issues and things? And then there's times where as a public theologian, yes, I'm in conversation with God in public, right, through writing and through speaking. But I'm also, and I'm doing those things in order to make sense of our world and what's happening and help people make sense of this world, because people have questions, you know, about when we talk about Black Lives Matter, or we talk about, you know, climate change or things that were happening. A lot of these questions are actually existential questions. You know, Black Lives Matter, that is a statement, you know, about our worth, our dignity, our intrinsic worth that's God given, God gave to us, right? Being made in the image of God. And so trying to give people the theological language, contours, and import for the questions that they're asking and letting them know, yeah, you're on the right track. Yep, you're right to ask that question. Yes, you should be mad about that, you know, because God is angry about that. And this is how we know God is angry about that. Through God's words. That's my job. It's to be able to connect the dots for people and for the public as a whole, and to do that as faithfully as I can and in submission and by God's grace, in hopefully in humility to God.
I love that. So who are you listening to? Who are some of your favorite theologians?
Oh, goodness. Oof. I don't know if, you know, honestly, I'm not gonna lie. It's my grandmama.
I love it.
Because going to seminary and learning and reading all these books and being, you know, in public theology, I think you can really get lost in the weeds of academic, or even the ivory tower of academia, and lose sight, I think, of the fundamentals of the faith and the basics of the faith,
yeah.
You know, because it's really love that's really in the details, right? That's the as the old adage goes. And I think sometimes it's just the basics, you know, and I learned from my grandmother some very deep theological truths, like the hypostatic union, like God is both God, 100% God and 100% man. My grandmother, my Nigerian grandmother, taught me that. Right. She taught me the creeds. She taught me how to pray. She taught me King James Version of our Lord's Prayer.
Yeah.
You know, she taught me these things. And so I'm so grateful that she's still here with us in the land of the living. So she's one that I really look up to. I look up to my mentor in the faith, who is Holiness Is Still Right. Love her, Stephanie Evans. And so I really try to keep it real simple on that. And I know that might be surprising to people, but I really try to, like, let me stay with that old time religion. You know, that God, the things that God used to draw me and bring me in, I believe that those are the things that will keep me. But with that said, that doesn't mean I'm not reading. I have been, presently, I'm reading a book called Faith in the Face of Empire.
Ooh.
By Mitri Raheb. So the Bible through Palestinian eyes.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's been really eye-opening. It's not a very big book, but goodness, it is small but mighty. And I just in some ways I'm trying to lay hold of the global nature of Christianity. Because I think in America, we're very, very privileged. I think in some ways that we can get pretty myopic about our faith, and we can get pretty, I hate to say this, but very much like our interpretation first, right?
Right,
which echoes, you know, the last regime. And so I think in some ways we can get really, you know, we can be a little imperialistic with our stuff sometimes. And that's across the board.
Yeah.
So I think that, I was like, you know, I think it'd be good and advantageous for me to actually read from a scholar who is Palestinian, who derives from one of the Bible social locations. And the Bible has, you know, several social locations, and just really like the right there in the heart of it in Palestine. Let me learn from that and what it means, you know, to be a Palestinian Christian and what their plight is, right? And dealing with empire. And so I've been reading, and I've been learning a ton. So that's what I'm reading currently, even though I'm writing. But when I do have time, I'm reading this.
I love that. I mean, I think one of the, I'm not going to remember her name, but uh-huh. I had to read, I found an article about Ruth and Naomi written by a Korean American female theologian, and it deepened my understanding. Yeah. Like, I cannot read the Book of Ruth the same. And I, like, I feel like seeing it as, like, a romance, which is, like, the Christian way of seeing it, is, like, Boaz and Ruth, is just, you miss so much of the context of the texture of what that story is about. And I'm like, love that. I'm going to write that down to get it. Because I think reading scripture from theologians outside of the West really will just, it'll blow your mind. We're missing so much. We're missing so much. And I think also too, when you talk about reading scripture or doing Bible study, you know, you want to do it in your local church or local community, but the church, to your point, is like global. Like we should be reading scripture and doing Bible study with the big C church.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I love that. That's so great.
Yes. Yes. And to your point, you see, so you mentioned reading about the story of Ruth from a Korean female theologian. And that's why we do need to hear from women theologians. We have a different vantage point. Now, obviously, my vantage point is going to be different from a Korean woman's, from an Indian woman, right? From a Taiwanese woman. But we need to hear. These are valid vantage points that we need to hear. And so it's just a beautiful mosaic and tapestry of like interpretation and things that we can glean outside. And that's not to say that us in America don't have anything to contribute. That's not what I'm saying. But I don't think we're the only ones that can contribute. And we're so far removed from the context of the Bible, meaning culturally, socially, in some ways, politically. I think it would behoove us to learn from people that are a little bit closer to that context, the biblical context anyway.
That's so good. Okay, so I wanted to ask you, you wrote over the course of the pandemic two pieces about the pandemic for The Atlantic. We're going to link those pieces in the show notes. I highly recommend them to our listeners. But one of the things that struck me in both pieces is you talk about grief. And the role of grief, or, you know, to use the more Christian lament, in this way of like a new imagining, how it's important, how like we can't skip that process. And so I was wondering if you could just say more about the role of grief or lament and sort of why that's an important any step of like reimagining or rekindling, or why is grief and lament an important part of human flourishing?
Yeah. Goodness. So, yes, I did write those two in this ongoing parallelogram. It's still happening. We're still in it. I know people want to pretend that we're not. And that is the problem. I think part of the problem is that because we have not properly grieved and we have not properly lamented, the thousands upon thousands of lives, over 600,000, well over 600,000 lives that have been lost to COVID-19 pandemic. I think it's calcifying the hearts. You know how the Bible talks about in 2 Timothy, the hearts of many will wax cold. Mm-hmm. I often tell my co-hosts, Christina and Michelle, that we live in a 2 Timothy world. You know, where it's just like, there's just, the love is just wax cold.
Yes.
There's no real empathy. There's no real care. You know, I see the posts on social media from people that are kind of like, you know, that have a proclivity, some of our cousins that have a proclivity toward conspiracy theories that are on my timeline. So I'm talking about my people too, you know. That's why I said our cousins. You know, and it's just like, my goodness, like just the callousness, like of somebody saying, you know, discouraging or disseminating misinformation, say about the vaccine, right? And somebody in that, and some another commenter says, you know, well, I just lost my brother to COVID-19 or blah blah, and the person just says, oh, well, I'm sorry about that, but if you just take these vitamins, blah blah blah, just callous. Disregard.
It's like the Hunger Game.
Yes. It is.
Every man for himself.
It is. I mean, the survival of the fittest. What is happening? Just ruled by this just rudimentary, rugged individualism. Very American. And I think the absence of grief, the absence of lament is has hardened us. And I think the reality is that when we grieve and we will lament about the things that ought to be lamented about, like death, the very thing that made Jesus himself cry, and weep right over the death of his friend Lazarus, we agree with God that something is wrong. We agree with God that death is evil. We agree with God that things ought not be like this. And when we do that, when we reflect the right response in a reflection of God who created us, we show forth that we really and truly are made in the image of God, that even when we don't do that, we are still Imago Dei. So I'm not saying that even when we don't act right, we are. But I'm just saying that we reflect just God's character. When we agree with God, when we have emotions that are aligned with God's emotions, right? So there's teaching about the communicable attributes and the incommunicable attributes of God. So communicable attributes are love, right? So we can love because God loves. That's a characteristic. God is love. And so we have characteristic, that ability to love people. And an incommunicable attribute is God's omnipotence, God being all powerful, God being omniscient, meaning he's all knowing. Okay, that we are not. Yeah. We are not all knowing. We are not all powerful. We are finite. God is infinite. So, but being able to grieve, being able to feel sadness, being able to see, call evil, evil, and good, good. My goodness, that's a reflection, I believe, of God's character and the fact that we are made in the image of God. And when we don't do that, I think it grieves God. I think it does grieve God. And I'm concerned for the trajectory that we're on right now, as it was reported about a week or two ago. Now, these numbers can change, but at this juncture, we were losing 2,000 people per day. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of lives. That's a lot of empty seats at dinner tables in houses all over this land. And we should be lamenting and grieving that. And I actually think the church ought to be the ones that are leading us in that way.
I completely agree. So for you, you're speaking about a lot of hard topics, and you speak publicly about hard topics. So could you maybe talk a little bit about tone policing and the pressure that Black women feel to tone it down? I'm putting my fingers in quotation marks here. Mm-hmm. And how can we also celebrate our gifts instead of feeling the need to shrink in order to fit into certain spaces?
Yes, yes. So yeah, tone policing and talking in public. Yes, I do. I do talk in public. I think, so for me, with regard to tone policing, I was very reluctant about, you know, this calling, to be honest. I really always, you know, when I went to seminary, I didn't know why I was going. I did not know what God was asking me to do. I was just trying to be faithful to where God had led me. And though it was very, very a difficult and pretty traumatic experience, I pushed through and made it through by God's grace, and still was like, okay, God, what are we doing? What are we doing? Cause really I just wanted to, go back to get that studying, go back to my local church, do discipleship, work a regular 9-to-5. And that's it. Serve the Lord for the rest of my days in that way.
Yeah.
I was satisfied with that. I did not seek after this. I mean, and I'm still would be fine with that, actually, God, if you'd like to.
If you'd like
to bust a Yui, we can do that. But you know, I think I come into this a little bit from a different stance. So going into this, it was not me that was going after this, you know, this calling. I didn't even know that this was a thing, meaning public theology. I didn't know that really until maybe the latter half of seminary. But I just, you know, but your gifts do make room for you. And so it just started happening. And, you know, so I knew that God had called me to speak and had given me a heart and passion for these hard things that have to do with injustices and oppression, particularly oppression and injustice that has to do with Black people. That would be on the continent, that would be in the diaspora, here in America. You know, like, that's where my calling, that's where my passions, that's where my gifts lie, and especially due to my social location. And so I have, of course, people have tried to tone police me, yes, but I've never felt the pressure to succumb to that, because I knew that my calling came from God. because I didn't want to do it in the first place.
That's good. That's good.
That's how I know I came from God, because I didn't want to do it in the first place. That's step one. Two, I was like, I cannot be a servant of God, you know, as Paul says in Galatians, and serve men. Like, it's not going to work. Like, if I'm going to be trying to please man, I won't be able to please God. If I try to please God, I'm probably not going to be able to please man. But I'm gonna please God because God sent Jesus to die for me. And he's the one that set me free. And my life belongs to God. And so I do what God tells me to do. And so that has been the anchor and the guide for me when speaking. So there are things that when I have to speak and I have to say some things, I'm praying, I'm asking the Lord, okay, what do you want me to say? Mm-hmm. What are the things that I can bring out? You know, just even on an interview like this, a conference stage, if I'm on doing a TV ad on MSNBC, God, what do you want me to say? What do you want me to write? If I'm writing something for the Atlantic, what do you want me to say that might help to maybe illuminate the darkness, that might help to bring some insight, some nuance? I'm just asking God to show me. And sometimes the Lord will really give me a hard word. And actually a lot of times.
I was going to say.
Like 99.9% of the time. And so I've got to say a hard thing. And I have to set my face like flint and do it, you know, and trust that the Lord will take care of the rest. And honestly, whenever I face backlash, which does happen probably about annually at this point, I trust the Lord to defend me. And I oftentimes rarely ever need to defend myself, even when I'm being attacked, when there's like a big, even like a little media controversy. I do not. I just be like, I pray again. I'm like, Lord, did I miss it? Did I say what you want me to say? I will check in with my community. Y'all, am I tripping? Did I misspeak? Do I need to repent of something? Because I'm not. I am fallible. Right. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to miss it. But I also try to check in and be like, and if people are saying, no, you're good, you know, or then, OK, then I'm going to sit back and just watch God do what God does. And each time God has really defended me, like brought people up, raised people up. And I'm like, oh, wow. OK, I'm just going to sit back and trust God.
Yeah.
And wait, sometimes time, you know, the words take time. The veracity of the word is tested with time, you know? And so people in that moment will be like, oh my gosh, this is hyperbole. She's just so negative. And then a couple of years later, like, oh yes, a whole coup did happen. You're right. You did call this the regime. Yes, I did. And so I'm just like, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, y'all. I mean, I'm just trying to call a thing a thing. So. Anyway, so tone policing. So I would say to people that are struggling though with tone policing or have succumbed to it, let me say it that way, because I do think I'm a little bit weird in that way, and that I'm like, eh. I'm gonna do
it. I love it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what that is, but for those that do feel pressure to do that, I would say go back to God and ask God, is this what God's calling you to do? Did God tell you to say this thing and on this platform, in this way, in this space, wherever God has you, right? Check in with God. And I also would say, this is kind of like a little bit of a tangent, but our callings or the function of our callings and the way that our callings manifest change. Yeah. They shift, you know, and I think we should be malleable and open and hold everything loosely and be ready to shift with God, because God changes our plans so quickly. Yeah. You know, like sometimes overnight, you're like, wait, what? What are we doing? You're like, okay, I did not get the memo, but all right. Either I'm going to shift or I'm going to get stuck and I'm going to keep wandering around the wilderness, or I'm going to go do what God told me to do. And so I think, I would say go back to God, check with God. If that's what God gave you to do, then you ask God for the confidence and the boldness to carry out your calling and your assignment. Now, if God is saying that the time has expired and I'm shifting you to something else, then have the humility and the obedience to shift along with God.
Yeah.
I hope that's helpful.
No, it's so helpful. I think that's a good word, because I think all to your point, it's like, are we trying to please God? Or are we trying to please man? And if the bottom line question is obedience, if God has, to your point, given you that word for that audience, for that time and place, for that meeting, for that Bible study, then it's really not a question of like how other people receive it. It's a question of like, am I going to be obedient or not? And then I think when you frame it that way, it's like, well, I'm going with God.
I'm going with God. Yeah, for God I live and for God I die.
Yes. Yeah.
That's for real. I'm really serious about that.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about obedience no more and holiness. I know it ain't cool. Because it don't get you no likes on Instagram. But obedience and holiness, that's it. Out of love for God and God's love for us. And we saw that. We saw Jesus demonstrate that in his obedience unto death to God's will, right? Yes. To save us. So come on now. Again, back to the basics. This is why I say back to the basics of the faith.
Exactly. I love it. That was such a good word.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, so still kind of related to the same topic, you know, I know we kind of know, we've talked about Black women are marginalized in predominantly white spaces, but I think one thing I think that gets less attention, or we don't have as many conversations about, or it feels uncomfortable to have this conversation, is the way in which Black women are marginalized in the Black church. And I, you know, kind of talked about that. I spoke to you for an article about in Christianity Today. And I just wanted to like revisit that conversation. We had Tyler on, you know, last season, and he kind of talked about it. But for you, could you speak to some of the ways that Black women are marginalized in Black church spaces and what we should expect from our Black brothers in terms of being better partners in ministry and calling and church life?
Yes. So, that's a doozy. you know, I love the Black church. I got saved in the Black church, came to faith in the Black church in college. And, you know, I do think, and you know what? Let me say this one. I'm sure this is as often being said now, which is good, is that the Black church is not a monolith, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a variety, a diversity of theological commitments, of theological beliefs, right? About the function and roles within church, particularly with the pastorate within the Black church, right? There's some that are completely egalitarian. I got saved in a Baptist Pentecostal egalitarian church. There was non-denominational. Hope's House Christian Church is where I got saved. And so Pastor Dre and Pastor Charles Humphrey were my pastors. And so in that space, you know, there was no restriction as far as, you know, preaching goes and pulpit ministry in that, you know, in that church. And then there's other churches where they do believe that a pastor, the role of a pastor or elder is reserved for a man. We're just, there's not going to be agreement on that, on this side. I will say, I will put my cards on the table that I have never ever felt a call to the pastorate, to be a pastor. I am the granddaughter of a pastor. But I've never felt that call, that unction, that was my calling. And so I do come into that conversation with, I would say, a bit of privilege in that. And that, so this is not something that's, that conversation is not as personal to me, because that's not something that I've, ever wrestled with at all. I think people want to be like, oh, you should. No, I shouldn't. That's not my call. That is not my call. You do not want me to be a pastor. You don't. I don't have the temperament. I don't have the call. It ain't it. And so, and you need to know that about yourself. Self-awareness. Yes. But I think that's the obvious one that people will name is, you know, is the restriction of women from the pastorate and pulpit ministry, which is legitimate. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not saying that it's not a legitimate complaint to bring up. But I do find that in Black church spaces, there were, because I think that when we just centered on that, then what happens to say women like me and others are like, actually, I've never had a desire to be a pastor, but I do have gifts and callings. You know, I have a gifting for teaching. I got a gift for evangelism. I have the gift of prophecy. You know, I'm just thinking about all these, maybe administration, you know, all these different gifts. What happens when you're in a church that is so rigid and so restrictive that the only gifts that are prized or esteemed are the outward gifts? Right. That are the public gifts, right? That you can see. So like on a Sunday morning, who is up front, you know, who is seen, who preaches, who, you know, what about the many other gifts, in the body of Christ? And so I think that there are ways that Black women in Black churches are sometimes lifted up, in that in certain spaces, Black women are given their opportunities to be able to gift, to know their gifts and to sharpen their gifts. I was definitely at that church, at my previous church, the first church where I came to faith, for sure. But then there are others where that's not the case, you know, where women are, how can I say, I talk about this actually in the Church Table book, my own experiences in another church that was completely opposite of Hope's House, and where the pastor was straight up misogynistic. There's no other way to say that, you know, objectifying women from the pulpit, making Black women the butt of the joke, right? To get his rocks off. Right. And it had absolutely nothing to do with the sermon. I think those were marginalized in those ways. Right. There's no real power sharing. Right. Because if you're in a position and you are the one that's the steward over the souls of God's people in that house, then you should be the servant. Right.
Yeah.
You know, you should be the servant. Yeah. The last shall be least, you know, I mean, the first shall be last. I'm sorry. But it is actually the last is least, actually. I was actually writing that. It's the last that's least. And that shouldn't be it. You have a greater responsibility to make sure that you too are among the sheepfold. Right? That you too are getting down and dirty with us in this rugged world, because it is rugged and it is dirty when you're dealing with people and our mess, because we all have mess. We should be able to walk shoulder to shoulder, right, with our pastors. And I think there's ways in which I think women, Black women in Black church spaces can be marginalized. Think about the fact that Black women, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, but there is a good number of us that are single, right? Mm-hmm. And single late, much later than our other female counterparts, you know, of other races, right? And so if you go to a church where, say, it's all male leadership, and I'm not saying that there are not women pastors that don't have internalized misogyny, that do not also spew rhetoric, because that is also a thing. You know, Sarai and Hagar stand as an example, right, of somebody. Sarai stands as an example of somebody who's complicit, right, mm-hmm. in the oppression of Hagar, right? Yeah. So I don't want to act like that's not a thing. But I'm just trying to make an example here that if you go to, say, a church, all male leadership, you know, and they have a very, let me say, idolatrous view mm-hmm. of marriage, you know, where the married people are a little bit esteemed a little higher. There's a hierarchy, right? Where they're esteemed and they're the favored ones of the Lord because they're married. And you have this thing where single women are off limits for interaction, for conversation. You don't see them as peers. Then those Black women in those spaces are going to definitely, by default, are going to be marginalized, right?
Right.
Simply because they do not have a partner, simply because, or a spouse, however you want to designate that. But I mean, think about that. What is the toll, you know, right, on Black women when that happens, right? Or even just think about even the ways that maybe the issues that we face are not dealt with the depth and nuance that it requires. Yeah. Like what is the impact of this financial toll? What does this mean long term mm-hmm. for singles that may not ever get married? Single Black women that may not get married. What are those things? And how is the church addressing that? Are you just simply saying, you know, that, oh, okay, you just need to be content in your singleness? It has nothing to do with contentment. There's a real systemic issue going on here. And so, and I do listen, I go all the way in on this subject in the Truth Table book. Because
it's important.
Because it requires.
It's important. It's good. That's good. Yes. Pre-order the Truth Table's book. We're going to include a link in the show notes of where you can do that. Support Black bookstores if you can. We're always supporting.
Bookshop.org.
Yes. So for sure. That's great. I mean, I think that's true. Your point about like the examples that are used and Black women being the butt of the joke. I was visiting a church. I'm trying to find a new church as I moved to Dallas. I was visiting her church. And the sermon was actually good. I mean, I was into it. And then at some point, he decides to make some analogy where he blames Faith Evans for Tupac and Biggie's beef, death, calls her a distraction. And I just am like, this is the kind of like, to your point of like, it that's misogynist. And I feel like for Black men, I think they're very hyper aware about, you know, the ways in which they're marginalized, you know, with police and, you know, and their employment and their sort of opportunities.
Absolutely.
And they don't think about, like, that's just, to me, I was just like, why would you even say that? It's disrespectful to Faith Evans. If you've done any reading on the topic, like, you know, their issue had to do with their own egos and like, she was dragged into something she didn't even want to be a part of, but like, why is it a Black woman's fault? Like, why, you know?
Absolutely.
And to your point, given the demographics of most Black churches, like, come on, man.
We're the majority, right? And when I say Black church, I'm also including, I think when we say Black church, I think we have to broaden what we mean too. I'm also including African church. I'm including Caribbean churches too, right? Because of the arrival of Black immigrants, of which I'm a first gen Nigerian American, I think you have to include them. You know, in that analysis. And so, it's a real issue. That misogynoir, it's in there, right? It's in there. And so how can you believe Black women? How can you believe Black women when you don't trust them? We don't trust our testimony about our struggles, our testimony about our very real experiences in church or whatever the whatever it is that we happen to be talking about or bringing, you know, to the fore or bringing to the attention of, say, the pastoral staff, you know. So I think it's a real serious issue. You know, you see this even the mess with R. Kelly, who now has been found guilty.
Thank God.
Praise God.
You know, but it's just like, my goodness, this attraction and draw to like just this power and celebrity for ill-gotten intentions. You know, I think we see that happen in the church. And I do think that eventually it's not a matter of if, but when I think the abuses, that sexual abuse, you know, and things that happen also in the Black church, I think that will eventually come to the light and will be exposed. It ain't every church. It is not the whole Black church at all. But yeah, I think that there is going to be a reckoning for these things because everything that's in the dark will come to the light.
Ooh, I completely agree with that. And I think everything you're saying is so powerful. And we talk so much about singleness on this podcast because neither of us are married. And so we just talk about what is that like, you know, for us to be in our 30s and navigating that and to be walking, you know, in your faith and doing what you feel God has called you to do. But also knowing that in a lot of church spaces, motherhood and being a mom and a wife is seen as now you're a woman and it's almost as if you're not, you know, walking in the fullness of your womanhood if you don't have those identities, labels attached to your name. And so it's a much broader conversation. So I cannot wait to dig into your book and read so many more of your thoughts on this. And I would love for people who might not be familiar with your work with Truth Table, if you could tell us about like the podcast itself, why you started it, and, you know, like the conversations that y'all are cultivating over there.
Yes, yes, yes. So Truth Table, my goodness. Okay, let me say, you mentioned the book. The book is Truth Table, Black Women's Musings on Life, Love, and Liberation. And so I will say the chapter on singleness, it is the longest chapter. And so, because I said everything I needed to say.
Yes.
on there. So Truth Table, honestly, is, my goodness, it is obviously the anchor, right, for the book. And so it's, it is, yeah, I would say it's the anchor. So it's a table built by Black women and for Black women. My co-host, Michelle Higgins, and Dr. Christina Edmondson. It's the three of us who host Truth Table, which was established in March 2017. Wow. Can't believe it. 5 years ago, going on six by God's grace. I mean, so we've had we're in our fifth season, wrapping our fifth season up at the end of October. And we'll be going into sixth season next year. And so how Truth Table came to be was that actually our producer came to me and said, hey, you know, you got a lot of good thoughts. You should do a podcast. And I was like, I don't know about that. Like, I don't even really listen to podcasts like that. Truthfully. I was like, what? A podcast? You know, I was like, I don't think I want to carry a show by myself. Because, you know, I'm thinking, many words, a lot of sin. Like, you know, I'm like, nah, there's too many opportunities to air here. I was like, but. I was like, but if I can do this, I was like, but then he was like, well, what about if you, Michelle, and Christina did a show together? I was like, that might could work. I was like, we just started a group chat, like, I don't know, a couple months ago. So I was like, huh, this might actually work, actually. And so, I pitched the idea to them, and they were like, game. And so we started recording the podcast. Now, we didn't know what we were doing at first. We didn't know all that went into a podcast at all. We didn't know all the work that it would take. And we didn't know the impact and reach that Truth Table would have, to be honest. We just knew that from our vantage point and the little bit that we knew about podcasts, we didn't know of any other podcasts that were doing what Truth Table was doing. So we were like, all right, let's do it. And so we started that podcast and we went in talking about issues that sometimes are hot button issues, right? So talking about gender inequity, like gender apartheid, and talking about colorism, talking about reparations, okay? Before it really started to get into at least the cultural, the Christian milieu, you know. So back in 2018, we did the Reparations Now series and did a whole series that medical apartheid, are you okay, sis? Talking about the health of Black women, are we okay? And the answer is no. It's still no, we are not okay. So, you know, so talking about these things that that we know our sisters care about. And so right. It's Black women who get a seat at Truth Table. Everybody else who is not a Black woman gets standing room section only. They're welcome into the room. They can gather around the table, but only the seats at the table are only reserved for Black women. And obviously, that's for very obvious purposes. I think you guys know. You all know that, you know, we're often marginalized and put to the side. And so we were like, no, we will make a special place for our sisters here at the table. And it's been a gift and a blessing to me.
I love it. It's so great. Yes. Get Truth Table wherever you listen to podcasts. Hopefully you are a podcast listener, although I understand those who are not. Okay, so the last question we've been asking this season of most of our guests is what they're hopeful about. I feel like there's a lot to grieve, to lament in the world. And that's mm-hmm. important, as we've stated. But I think sometimes you think it has to be one or the other. And I think it can be both. Hope and lament can coexist. And so I'd love to know for you what's something you're hopeful about right now.
What am I hopeful about? Goodness, I'm really trying to anchor my hope. Well, my hope is continually on the Lord. Right. To be honest, because listen, everything seemed to be falling apart. I'm serious. I mean, I hate to be a negative Nancy, but I'm just saying, it's just like, things are just like, I was like, this is just a lot going on. And so I think if nothing else in these couple years, I'm like, okay, our hope really does have to be in Jesus. Like, because nothing is holding up, right? It just feels like everything is just a crumbling a bit. I think I'm always going to be hopeful though about the younger generations coming up after us. What can we learn from them? What are some things that we can teach them if they receive from us? And so I think I'm hopeful to see how Gen Z and the generation after Gen Z, I don't know what the generation's name is.
AY, I don't really know.
Okay.
It's Alpha, I think it goes back to the beginning.
I know. Oh, really? Okay. I don't know.
I don't know.
But I'm looking forward to seeing just kind of like what are the characteristics that shape those generations? You know, there's been a whole lot of talk about my generation, the millennials, you know, that people been hating on us, you know.
From the beginning.
Some of this criticism is legit. I will say that. Some is a lot of projection and illegitimate. Okay. But I'm excited about learning just kind of, okay, what really is the ethos of these next generations and what can we learn from them? Where will they take us? Will they progress us, help us to progress, hopefully, or will we be regressing, right? I don't know. The question is, it's a question, you know? And so I think that, and in that question, I think there's still some hope there, right? Even in the unknown, there's hope. Because, you know, even in our faith, we don't know how it all's going to end. We really don't. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the word. I'm not saying, but we don't know. Jesus could come at any moment. And so we gotta be ready, right? But yeah, so that's kind of what I'm hopeful about the next generation. I'm curious, and I'm hopeful and curious to see how the next generations, will lead us. What will their bents be? What will their proclivities be? Mm-hmm. Z's is being, of course, much more solidified now, right? Because they're right behind millennials. But yeah, I'm just curious about that and hopeful that they can lead us on. Because listen, it's time to pass the baton. Look, y'all.
And I think it's helpful to remember that, like, millennials now, like, the oldest millennials are in their 40s. Yeah. Like, so some of the ways in which people talk about millennials, it's like, you're talking about grown people. Like, please distinguish between millennial and
Z, right?
And Z and Alpha or whatever they're called. Because some of the stuff you're saying, I was like, would you walk up to a 40-year-old's face and say that? You would not. So
I'm telling you.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. This was so good. I'm so glad that you were on. We're going to do Faith.
Yeah. We're going to do our favorite segment and yours. Go off, sis. Okay, so this is our time where we like to talk about something we love right now, are blessed, and then also something that's just a mess. And this is just our personal time of sharing those things. These things range from serious to silly to just, you know, something nice and lovely. So this is our time. You know, we just like to talk. We like to chat.
Okay, go off, sis. Okay, what I'm loving right now, honestly, is my Black Peloton writers group.
Yes! Tell me more. I'm like, should I get a Peloton?
I love this group. Well, I love the Peloton. You know, I'm serious about working out now. I've been working out for many, many, many years since I was in my early 20s. And so I work out about 5 days a week. Okay, for about 2 hours, and it's not a game. And so Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to about 7 a.m., I'm working out. And so I have this Peloton, which I love, and there's a Black Peloton writers group on Facebook, and I love them, my Pelow cousins. And so I was reluctant to share this because I was like, I don't want us to get, you know, I like to keep it, but you know, I want people to know about it. So it's a group of just, you know, you gotta be Black to be in a group and you gotta have a Peloton, you know, to be in a group. And it's just, I don't know. It's just so much banter and just motivation, encouragement. We push one another to hit our fitness goals, to get on the bike, motivate, pray for one another when, you know, when people are struggling or a family member is going through things or somebody lost a family member. Just a sophisticatedness that pops off in the group. I love it. Every day I'm in that group. I think I joined like in February or March. I'm telling you, I promise you, that's how I'm getting over. Jesus and my Black Peloton group is how I'm getting over.
I love it.
It's such a blessing. Now for the mess is the time.
Yeah, for the mess.
For your mess.
Whoo. Ooh-wee. Oh, I mean, goodness. I mean, I don't think you guys have a whole nother hour for the messes. But the most prescient mess that's coming to mind at the moment is the way that this administration, the Biden administration, is deporting Haitians by the hundreds and thousands. Yes. And the way that they had that, what do you want, a cowboy, I'm going to say, cowboy, whipping Haitian migrants who are coming, who are trying to fight for their livelihood and for the survival of their family. That was a mess. It was a wicked mess.
Yes, it was.
And it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. It is absolutely terrible. There's absolutely no difference between Biden's immigration policies and Trump's. And I'm going on record to say that. And unless something changes, I'm not retracting that.
Yeah.
And so that is the indignities these people have suffered to take these people and then put them on a plane, send them back to Haiti, which they had left years ago. They had already settled in different countries within South America. And then you go and take them almost to Atlanta. You could almost say for many of them that they know not now, right? Because they've been gone for so long. Then you see them coming off of the plane and they put their belongings just on the tarmac, unlabeled and anything, as if they haven't suffered enough indignities by being whipped for an inch of their lives, trying to survive, and then living under a bridge in the heat in Del Rio, Texas, okay? Then getting off of the plane, having to rummage through to figure out what is theirs because their belongings are not labeled. That is a mess. That is wicked, and that is deplorable. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick of the ways that we are being used for our vote and then never, ever, ever get any reciprocity.
You better say that.
We don't get any reciprocity. Do we got canceled student loan debt? No. Do we have universal basic income? No. Do we have our voters' rights free and clear? Are they restricted? They're restricted still.
Yes.
So what are we doing?
What did we work so hard for? Is what I want
to
know.
And then that you will have nerve enough to show up in 2 years and ask me again for my vote
next year.
Yeah, talking about. Yeah, no, I'll include a link in the show notes. I actually wasn't aware in the ways in which consistently across presidential administrations, Haitians and specifically have been singled out.
Yes, America owes Haiti.
Yes, to be excluded from any sort of like asylum and refugee status that have been given to Cubans, now, you know, Central Americans. And I'm all for immigration reform. I'm all for people who are vulnerable being able to come to the United States. But there's a deep, deep anti-Black racism in our immigration policy. And to your point, Biden, he deported Haitians under a Trump administration policy.
Title 42.
I'm with you.
Absolutely.
A mess.
Unless it changes, I'm not retracting that.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. I mean, it's so upsetting. Honestly, I could weep here. It's just, you don't treat people like that.
Yeah.
You do not treat people like that. You do not treat human beings like that.
Exactly.
But you know what? You treat chattel like that. Mm-hmm. And when the country does not see you as a human being made in the image of God, this is how they treat you. They treat you like chattel. And it's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. I cannot wait for the day that the Lord restores the people of Haiti. I cannot wait for the day. And also us too.
May it be so. So I like to start with my mess. Okay, so my mess is gonna seem trivial compared to that.
Oh, sorry, I didn't went off.
No. That is really good. And in some ways, you saying that freed me up for my trivial one. Okay, it's actually not trivial. I read that the dollar store, Dollar Tree, is going to start charging $1.25 and $1.50 on some items. Not Dollar Tree anymore. And that seems trivial, but when you realize it's related to global supply issues and COVID and all of these things, they're basically passing on the price to consumers. And immediately when I thought about that, it just, for me, it's like, you know, annoying. I'm annoyed. right? Because it's called Dollar Tree for a reason. I love Dollar Tree.
Yeah.
But for people who are in economically vulnerable, financially vulnerable situations that are not being paid a living wage, that 25 cents, that 50 cents is a big deal. So whatever needs to be done, needs to be done. And Dollar Tree, you cannot call yourself Dollar Tree if you're charging people $1.50.
Come on, Dollar Tree. I mean, that's true.
I'm like, are they, that's basically Dollar General now. But
yes.
Yeah, listen, Dollar General, I'd be like, they're kind of pricey.
Dollar General, why is it so expensive?
They should rename this, call it Cheap Tree. Budget Tree. I mean, I'm just
exactly. Yes, it's false. Dollar General. It's not a dollar anymore. Yeah, it's false advertising. Okay, so for my bless, I did a Twitter thread about this week, but I just started really thinking about the ways in which my family has been blessed by my parents' church family, where they've been faithful members for like 40 years as my dad is going through treatment. The ways in which we've had people like show up at our door with like meals. And I mean, we ate for 3 months on Grubhub.
Because,
you know, my dad can't go back to church in person because it creates such a... get too close.
Yes.
But I just, the faithfulness, I think sometimes, I will say, if we're talking about valid criticisms of millennial generations, I think our tendency to like move on so quickly and like say, okay, I don't like this. And sometimes it's valid. I'm not saying, I'm not saying that, you know, you need to stay in an abusive church environment, but you know, we'll be like, oh, I don't really like the worship or, you know, whatever. And like move on to the next thing. I really am seeing the value of really sowing faithfully where you're planted. And I just have been so blessed. I'm their daughter. I don't go to church there. I'm not a member there. But like just in the ways in which people have cared, have texted me, have sent flowers, like so that's my bless. And I also want to bless the jurors that convicted R. Kelly. And I'm sad that it took so long, but I praise God for justice when it does come.
And all of the men and women
you know, who would not let it go.
We're pushing. It's good.
Okay, I'm gonna do my, I guess I'll do my bless first, because I still really need to think of the mess, because there's a lot going on in the world right now. So okay, but my bless is very trivial, but I have been watching Big Brother, the newest season.
My sister loves that show, and I was like, hold up, I need to watch this season.
Tonight is the final episode. I'm so excited. I had taken a break on Big Brother, I'm not gonna lie, okay, but I went back to it this season only because I heard about what the Black people were doing in the game, and I had to watch it from the beginning. And I have been floored at seeing them pull this off, and then the white folks really not catch on to what they were doing. And shout out to Tiffany, because she was a big part of the strategy, and Big D getting everybody together. But I just love the fact that they work together, even though some of them just did not like each other. Like getting
they cannot stand each other. Like they really can't. And I think that speaks to the strength of that alliance.
That's beautiful, though, right? I think there's a message there. Okay.
Yes, there's a message there. No, there's a huge message there. And it's so fascinating because it's like, yeah, they really don't get along, but they made, and honestly, for some of them, particularly Tiffany, it would have made more sense for her not to stick to that commitment she made to the other black contestants. And so, yeah, it's great. There is a parable. A lesson.
See what we could do
if we can just
stick together.
One singular focus.
If we could have one focus, okay? But there's just such this, we have to agree on it all. We don't, and we're not going to. So if we could just focus, the amount of change that we could produce, my God. So that is my bless.
I like that bless. Yes.
Yes.
Because like, there's a word in that bless.
It is. It's inspiration for me. And I feel like, can the community just take a hold of this? Can we just use this as an example? Like, y'all, please, when it's time for us to get something done, I might not even like you. You might not like me, but we have a mission at hand, and we will not divert from the mission because it is so important.
Yes. You don't have to like me to love me. I know that's a hard thing for people
it's
to
understand. It's the truth.
But let's let the love guide the work, okay?
Let's focus
on the one thing, whatever the one thing is. You know, and they were like, we're going to be the cookout and we're going to stick together. Like, you know, whatever. And we can disagree without being disagreeable, right? I think that's something we can learn from.
Yes.
From, you know, listen, I only saw an episode or two, okay? But,
but that is exactly right. But that's exactly right. We don't have to like each other to love each other, to keep the main thing. And like, you know, because what are we pushing? What are we pushing towards?
This group
and like,
think. This group think is too much. It's legalism. It's legalism dressed up.
It is dressed up. Okay, let's just say that that's going to be my mess. Groupthink, okay?
Okay.
Let's just make that the mess so we can broaden the conversation. But I've been pondering on that. It's like you can go from one set of groupthink and then feel like you're completely right and go to the other side of the pendulum, and it's the same groupthink. And I'm like, wait a minute. I mean, I hear you. And I agree on some things here, and I agree on some things over there. But the groupthink isn't going to get us anywhere. It's these different coin.
Same thing. Yeah.
So that's just really a mess right now, because I feel like we're so caught in these isolated silos.
Yes.
And how are we going to make progress forward if we're continuously in these same little groupthink, little groups? It's a cyclical cycle. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah, and social media certainly is not helping us.
It fortifies
our echo chambers. It really does.
It really does. The algorithm.
Your feed is curated where you already think. So you're not even being exposed to people who think differently or have different things to say. And I think you're right, Faith, that people think, oh, like, this goes both ways, you know, whether you lean more conservatively or, you know, liberal or progressive, like this idea that, like, you know, there's only one way to do things, or if you disagree about this, we can't do anything together. I can't be associated with you. It's just,
it's too much. It's too much.
It's too much.
It's exhausting. So yeah, I agree with y'all's blessings and messes.
Okay. Good.
It's a blessed mess out here. Okay.
It is a blessed mess. I love that. We are gonna use that. We will give you credit, but we are going to use that. Okay, guys. We are gonna say thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Ekumene for coming and being a part of Melanated Faith today. As we already said, guys, pre-order Truth Table's book. Pre-orders are very important for authors. You might not know that, but it means a lot to the publisher how much push and promotion they're going to give the book. So get this book. You're going to want it. Go to bookshop.org to find your local bookstore, independent seller. Rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to join our Patreon. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.